I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Aloha, Talking Biotechers! Today is a really special episode of Talking Biotech, as we lift our gaze to the beautiful islands of Hawaii. Now, over the last several years, Hawaii has been an epicenter of genetic engineering consternation. Large multinational companies treasure the islands because of their stable, warm climates. It's a place where they can produce two or three seasons of hybrid corn seed for the mainland farmer. The locals, they see this level of massive production as an infringement on paradise, and in many cases fear the plants and products that are used on them. There's even a rift that's developing between the people that live there and the people employed by the companies, who also are residents of the island. Now, I had an opportunity to integrate with this situation firsthand back in Kauai in 2013. And what I found was an island of passionate, good people that was split in two. My heart went out to the workers at the companies who are mostly proud employees with farming backgrounds. Many of them are descendants of farmers that used to work the land in sugar and pineapple companies in the decades past. On the other side, there's people living in fear of being poisoned. They're convinced that farming operations are killing them and harming their families and harming their fragile Hawaiian environment. Now, I understand all of their perspectives, and when I look through everyone's lens, it's really easy to see why there's no peace in paradise. Sadly, and maybe ironically, the collateral victim is the papaya, which has the opportunity to really unify all of these interests. You see, genetically engineered papayas are a common crop on the islands, particularly in the major production areas of Oahu and the Big Island of Hawaii. It's a major success story of genetic engineering. It also reminds us that these technologies are not just about big profits for multinational companies. These are products that are really, possibly, going to help people. So this episode of Talking Biotech centers around papaya. It's much more like This American Life than it is Science Friday. It's about how a problem came to cripple an industry, how smallholder farms suffered, and how technology came to the rescue to solve the problem. Now, in complete poetic justice, that technology came from one of Hawaii's native sons, a local kid with a speech impediment, so-so grades, and a knack for science that would find university mentors that would foster his interest in science to eventually solve this problem that plagued the island.
So today on Talking Biotech, a story in two parts. Act one, the words of Joni Kamiya. Joni is the daughter of several generations of papaya farmers. She tells her story about growing up on a farm threatened by disease and the changes that came from technology. Act two, Dr. Dennis Gonsalves, Hawaii's native son, comes home to solve the problem.
So once again, we're back on Talking Biotech, and really in our episode on papayas, it's important for us to understand the human element of the innovation. And the innovation came at a time that was really important, and we can see it in the textbooks, but nothing better than to talk to people where it was actually impacting their lives. And I'm very fortunate to sit with Joni Kamiya, who has not just been someone affected by the papaya innovation, but someone who also has been very effective and a voice in Hawaii on discussing biotechnology and its ramifications. So welcome to Talking Biotech, Joni.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm glad to have a chance to tell our story about the papaya, because it's not really heard enough. And just a little background on me. My dad is a longtime papaya farmer in Hawaii on the island of Oahu, and my grandfather was also a farmer. And right now, the farm is in the process of going to the next generation, my brother, which is one of the reasons why I decided to start speaking out. Because I was very worried that we would lose this farm if we were to have what the activists wanted, which was a complete ban of the technology. I was fortunate enough to be able to have an odd job in college of doing the initial papaya, doing the cross protection and going in the field and grinding up cucumber leaves and making a buffer and inoculating thousands of papayas. And I used to think that, you know, that was just a random job. I would never go into plant pathology because my dad would tell me, don't go into farming. The farm is dying. I don't know what we're going to do. So I never went into it, you know, and it was sad. It was really sad to see my dad's life work possibly disappearing.
Well, could we go back to that and start at the beginning of maybe what was papaya farming like for your grandfather and for your father, and then how the disease changed that?
Papaya farming, basically, they're all small farmers. It's all maybe 10-acre fields, maybe 2-acre fields. And the papaya tree itself is a long herbaceous tree, essentially. And when the flowers start coming out, the papayas are on there. And, you know, when the disease started, no one wanted to cut down their trees, whether it be a gardener, whether it be another papaya farmer, because they saw still papayas on there. Why would you want to cut down your tree? And my dad knew the devastation of the disease because of that. And so he would tell the neighbor, hey, your tree has disease. You need to cut it off. But, you know, these old farmers said, I'm not going to cut it off. There's still fruit. Why would I want to cut my tree and start all over? And so every time that happened, my dad's fields would get attacked. All the trees would have to be cut down little by little as they got the disease. My dad's farm had to keep moving all over the place. And so the farm was Waikane, went to another place, and eventually, no matter where we went, the disease kept ravaging it. Every time, my dad would have to take the machete, cutting down the trees. And that's why it looked really futile in the early 90s, because there was no stopping of the disease.
And just to give this more of a context for listeners, this is on the Big Island, this is on Oahu. This is on Oahu. And so when you're moving from place to place, you're moving around the edge of the island, or tell me a little bit about the area and how easy it is to move a papaya farm.
It's pretty difficult because you have to find affordable land. You have to move all your equipment. You have to move all your tractors, all your processing, all your sheds, everything. It's a logistical nightmare, essentially. And it makes farming that much harder. The ground is different. The way you're going to farm, the way you're going to plow is different. It's tremendous amount of extra work that, you know, was hard. Every time your fields die, you had to move. Very, very difficult.
And so when you heard about the innovations that were coming, or this potential solution, how did that come about? Was your father tied in with the science or the scientists, or how did that connection come about?
My dad has always been a papaya industry leader, so he's been Hawaii Papaya Industry Association leader, and so he's heard what has happened to other farmers, and he said, we need to do something. He's an innovator, and he said, we can't keep doing things the same way. We need to take the lead and change what we're doing, and here's a potential solution that can keep us all farming. And it can also keep us from having to plow down more forest to farm. So this is what his idea was with the industry, was we should use this solution to save the environment.
And that's really important in a place like Hawaii, where really farming has to integrate with a fragile environment and the fragile ecosystems. And to be able to maintain farming productivity and still be able to respect the island, which I know is so important to the people there, it almost seems that a biotechnology solution would be something that would be very welcome. And so what were those first times like when the first trees came, or and was there broad acceptance in the beginning?
For papayas in Hawaii, it is a staple. So people religiously go to the stores every day or every week to get their papayas because it's one of the most healthiest fruits there. And so my dad's longtime customers who no longer had papaya were just clamoring, when is the papaya going to be coming? When is the papaya going to be coming? So finally, when it got approved, they were thrilled. They were so happy. And just to show an example of how dedicated the customers are to papaya is that at a time, my dad would have a lot of off-grade. And, you know, he couldn't sell it in the market because it wasn't market grade. So he would just dump it in the back of the field or give it to the pig farmer. And I told my dad one day, he had 1,000 pounds one day. I said, you know, Dad, I want to sell it in my garage. So I put it in my garage and I sold it 1 week. Maybe 7 people came. The next week, 27 people came. The following week, there was like 50 people came. And, you know, it just showed how much people rely on that fruit. And Hawaii is just very unique in that people love it there. And my dad loves growing a quality fruit, and he loves doing it because he likes the people saying, oh, that is good stuff. That's the best.
And I love those kinds of stories because we're talking about something that's a local staple that now can be grown locally and, you know, sold out of a garage to people who want it. And these are the stories that we hear in, you know, in other production methods as being like these very homey kind of feel to them, but really was the case with papaya. And so when did you start to see resistance to this idea, meaning not viral resistance, I mean resistance from the public against this idea?
Actually, we've always had a very small minority of resistance for years, mainly with the little anti-GMO groups that were there before. But it really started to grow with the research on the taro, the GMO taro possibility. That really started a furor because it took a cultural symbol and got people really involved, and then they started that whole campaign. And what made it really worse was the social media, where people were pumped out tons of information. And I happened to be on the social media early, just as a passive observer, and that's where I saw that the resistance started to grow, and I saw a lot of misinformation from online newspapers like the Civil Beat. Yeah. That started to really pump out misinformation. And that got me mad because I thought, why are they allowed to say this kind of stuff? And that's what prompted me to speak out.
Well, I'm so glad you have, because you've been such a good voice in this discussion. And your connection with a family farm and understanding the industry is so critical, because it allows us to cut through the bad information that we find in social media with an extremely credible voice. And how much have you been able to influence maybe the more contemporary discussions, like in the last couple of years, where they've wanted to impose such strong regulations, like on the Big Island, where in Puna and those regions where papayas are grown extensively, yet you have so many people, even celebrities, well, I don't know if Roseanne Barr is a celebrity anymore, but marginal, once relevant personalities, making up complete falsehoods about papayas.
Yeah, that... You know, Hawaii has been the central of this, how do I say? Essentially, it feels like a circus, because you have Roseanne Barr, you had Ben Stiller, you have this group called the Babes Against Biotech, just, you know, just a barrage of like a rainbow of people. And here we have most of the farmers there are predominantly Filipino, some Japanese, very small Asian farmers. And it's not in our culture to do that. So it's been a real difficult leap. However, having me lived on the mainland for so long, I decided, what do I have to lose? What if we don't speak up, we lose everything. And these people lose nothing. And misinformation will take away a farm. It will take away the farm from my kids. It will take away science innovation that my kids would want to do. It takes away education. And that, for me as a mother who's worried about my kids' future and what opportunities they will have in Hawaii, it bothers me to no end. It bothers me that we don't, this kind of fear-mongering prevents any kind of research from really taking place in Hawaii. Like, what if we wanted to do ALS research that might be biotech-based? They're not going to want to invest in Hawaii. Our people will be at a loss, and it's frustrating.
And the other big part about this, too, is the papaya was such a success story that came at a different time in a different regulatory climate and different suspicion of the technology, and was such a success and could have been the model that here a public effort not a big company. A public effort created this product that solved the problem for farmers, and that's how this should work. And to see that taken back or to be fought against as though it's something wrong and evil taints that beautiful model that we can do this as a public effort together to solve something that matters, and nobody's making a profit except for those farmers, and then people are getting the food they need. And so what do you see is happening right now and in terms of the current laws and rule changes, and maybe a little bit about the future of papaya farming and the GE papaya in Hawaii?
Well, basically, with all the anti-GMO laws passed on the county being invalidated, that was a bright spark in the whole issue in Hawaii, that yes, the farm laws should be regulated at the state level. That's where it lies. So it gave us a glimpse of hope. And it also helps empower our leaders to say, yeah, it belongs in that level. The misinformation still continues. We're always fighting, trying to defend our lives. But there's been a reprieve with the court hearing. So I'm kind of glad. So there is a glimmer of hope there.
Yeah, I really should add, just to get our listeners familiar, that each island is in fact a county in Hawaii. And so a county board of maybe 5 to 7 officials makes the decisions about county rules and county regulations and can pass ordinances that can restrict different kinds of farming practices. And this is exactly what's happened throughout the islands in different levels. And activists will go to an island where they can control a small number of local politicians and make decisions that have profound effects that are statewide. So the new movement has been, at least politically, to have there be some sort of overriding state rules that will dictate how counties may behave in these regards. Because you can't mothball a papaya farm. You know, let's just shut it down for a few years and we'll start it again sometime. I'll just take my livelihood elsewhere. You know, it just can't happen. Any thoughts on that?
That's why we need to empower the farmers to start speaking up, because we're a very small population. And not only do we need farmers to speak out, but we need the customers to speak out. And we really need to amplify the true benefits of what has happened. I mean, it was just a simple tool that revolutionized the industry in Hawaii. And, you know, that has implications far beyond farming. In Hawaii, we have many native species. They're under attack, too. Those implications passed at the county level will impede every single body's ability to save that native species, you know, and blindly boxing the GMO as bad issue is very dangerous. And as a state, we stand to lose a tremendous amount of things by taking that stance.
That's such a great note to end on. There's so much more that can be done here. And in a place like Hawaii, the technology can be a tremendous benefit. And so where can people find you if they were interested in more information, maybe about you, or they follow you on Twitter, website, something like this?
Basically, I had my alias, my blog, HawaiiFarmersDaughter.com. That's where you can find me. And my Facebook page is the same, HawaiiFarmersDaughter.com.
And I strongly recommend everybody take a look at this. It's a wonderful page, great information about Hawaii and other places too. I'm definitely a finger on the pulse of this particular topic. So, you know, Joni, thank you so much for your time, and hopefully it was really a pleasure to meet you in person. So thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for hearing our story. Oni nei ia loko
akapuai. So today is a really special Talking Biotech, because we have with us one of the true innovators of biotechnology as it really affected an industry that we don't normally think about. It's not a big ag crop, but rather a smaller regional crop that was suffering from a very bad viral disorder that luckily had someone step in to help solve the problem.
And we have on Dr. Dennis Gonsalves calling, well, today on, joining us on Skype from Hawaii. So, yeah, so you're really a hero to many people in the papaya industry and certainly a key person in the history of genetic engineering. And most people know what you did and your contributions to this, but could you tell me a little bit about what was happening in the Hawaiian papaya industry in the late 1980s when you stepped in to solve the problem?
The papaya ring spot virus actually was discovered in Hawaii in 1945 on the island of Oahu, where the main papaya industry was. And the virus actually wiped out the industry on the island of Oahu. So the industry moved to the Big Island in the district of Puna, actually, where they have the live volcanoes. And in there, in Puna, there was a lot of volcanic land. The land was cheap. They had 100 inches of water a year, 100 inches of rain a year, and a lot of sunshine. And they had a specific variety called Kapoho that was suitable for that area. So starting in the 1960s, the industry grew in Puna, and by 1970s, it represented 95% of Hawaii's papaya production. But very importantly, there was no papaya ring spot in the Puna district. But by 1978, the papaya ring spot virus was known in the town of Hilo, which was only 19 miles away. So given that this might be a potential problem to Hawaii's second most important fruit industry, the dean of the College of Agriculture at the University of Hawaii asked me to start to work on that. At that time, I was at Cornell University.
And when you started to work on this problem, did they ask you for a biotechnology solution, or was it more traditional plant pathology?
You know, in 1978, biotechnology was present, but in relation to developing virus-resistant plants and so forth, the concept had not really been developed. So they just asked me to try to determine if we could control the virus. And actually, the concept, a prevailing concept that could work at that time was the concept of cross-protection. And basically, this concept is idea is that if you inoculate a healthy plant with a mild strain of, let's say, the papaya ring spot virus, that plant would get infected by the mild strain and would prevent the infection or damage by a severe strain. So starting in 1978, I started trying to use cross-protection to control the virus. So we developed a mild strain, and by 1983, we actually had a mild strain, and we tested it under greenhouse conditions and under field conditions in Hawaii, and it really did work. It protected against severe infection of the Hawaiian strain. We tried that in Taiwan, and we found out that it delayed the infection but was not that effective.
Are there any natural sources of resistance, even in maybe wild papaya?
Well, you know, back, I would say, up to about maybe 10 years ago, there were other what they called species of Carica, and there were these what they felt were wild Carica papaya relatives, but it was not Carica papaya, was other species. Now, some of the species were resistant to papaya ring spot, but you could not get a viable cross between the Carica papaya and these other Carica species. And so they could not transfer the resistance gene. And in fact, now Carica papaya is in fact a lone representative of Carica papaya. The other Carica species that they felt were Carica species have been named a different name, Vasconcella.
Yeah, so there's no easy way to breed this in, and you're seeing cross protection and other types of management associated tricks break down. So what would lead you to the biotech solution of with the recombinant DNA solution of introducing, say, part of a virus in the genome in order to spur the plant's assault on the invading virus?
Yes, well, you know, as I mentioned, in 1983, we had developed a mild strain. We were working it and testing it in Hawaii, in Taiwan. But about that time, you know, the ability to isolate the genes of a virus, to clone them and so forth, were becoming not easy, but one could do it. And then the concept of pathogen-derived resistance was sort of put forward in 1984-85. So, and the concept was that if part of the pathogen, let's say a virus, let's say the code protein gene of the virus, was introduced into a plant, let's say the papaya, it would make that papaya resistant to that virus. And in fact, in 1985 and 86, Roger Beachy published on this technique showing that the code protein gene, when put into tobacco and tomatoes, rendered the transgenic tobacco and tomato resistant to tobacco mosaic virus. And just about the same time, the same year, John Sanford, who was actually just in a different building at Cornell, so we were friends, he published a paper essentially called Parasite-Derived Resistance, suggesting that this approach could work. So given the fact that our efforts on cross-protection was working, but it did not seem that effective, we started to our control method of trying to use genetic engineering. And at that time, I was very fortunate in that I had also been working with Jerry Slidham, who was at Upjohn Company, and they had just bought the Asgrow Seed Company. And they were trying to develop virus-resistant vegetables, primarily cucurbits and squash. And so they had contacted me since I was a virologist, and I had been working with him to develop genetically engineered squash that might be resistant to viruses like papaya ring spot, also infects squash, and then zucchini yellow mosaic virus, watermelon mosaic virus, and cucumber mosaic virus. So given all of that relationship with Jerry Slidham, we started to work on trying to develop a genetically engineered papaya that would resist the papaya ring spot virus. We took up the approach to develop a genetically engineered papaya for Hawaii. And this approach was the pathogen-derived resistance approach. Basically, we would use the code protein gene of the papaya ring spot virus and determine if we insert that gene into the chromosomes of the papaya, that it would be resistant. So the research team involved Jerry Slidham, an excellent molecular biologist who was employed at Upjohn, but Upjohn owned Asgrow Seed Company, and Asgrow Seed Company was trying to develop transgenic squash that resistant to a number of viruses. And then the other components of the team was Richard Manzart, a horticulturist at the University of Hawaii that was working on papaya, and Maureen Fitch, his graduate student, who was an employee of USDA. And she was part of the team. And so starting in 1984-85, we started this approach to develop a genetically engineered papaya that would be resistant to the virus using this concept. Now, still at that time, it's very interesting to know that even at that time, where in Pune, there was no virus in Pune, the state of Hawaii knew that the virus could jump to Pune. So they actually had a small band of people that would go around the town of Hilo and look for a virus-infected papaya, and they had authority to chop it down. So Hawaii was wary that it could go to Pune, where 95% of the papaya industry was. Now, the expertise of the team was Richard Manzer was a horticulturist, and Maureen Fitch was a very good at tissue culture. So her work was to do the tissue culture and then utilize the cold protein genes to try to transform papaya. And so Jerry Slidham, I collaborated with Jerry Slidham in getting the cold protein sequence engineered. And so this effort to try to transform papaya first started using agrobacterium. And for whatever reason, at that time, about 1986, the effort to transform papaya using agrobacterium did not work. Now, very fortunately, John Sanford, about 1985, had invented the gene gun. And as I mentioned earlier, he was just a building away from my lab in Cornell. So we utilized the gene gun, and starting in 1987-88, we did the first experiments to try to transform the Kapoho variety, which was the dominant yellow flesh variety, and the Sunset variety, which is a commercial papaya, but is a red flesh, but it wasn't a preferred cultivar in Hawaii. So around 1988, we did the first experiments actually using the father of the gene gun in Sanford's lab, where we utilized blank 22 caliber bullets to force this DNA that has coated the tungsten particles into the cells of the tissue culture, the papaya. And we got results of about 15 cell lines were regenerated of papaya. And some of these lines were cloned. These lines were actually cloned, about 10 clones per line, and then shipped up to me at Cornell. And in early 1991, I inoculated about 8 lines of this transgenic papaya. And this one line called 55-1, when I inoculated that, it showed resistance. And, it's very interesting. You go through this hypothesis, you say this might work, you go through the experiments, now you have, you have something that our test showed it has the cold protein gene. And then you lay out your experiments, the control have no gene, and then the lines have the gene, and then you inoculate them, and then the moment of truth is going to come. And so I inoculated them, and I washed them every day, and in about 15 days, the controls were showing virus symptoms, and one of the lines called 55-1, did not show any symptoms. And so the experiment continued for four weeks. And by 4 weeks, I was very confident that in the greenhouse, this line 55-1, which was not Kapoho, which was Sunset, a red flesh papaya, solo papaya that was commercial, but not the preferred variety, I showed resistance. And it's it's an incredible feeling when you think about something, how to do it, and then you actually come to a moment of truth in the greenhouse, and this one line looked good. And you know, I if I may, I'd like to add just a bit more. Now, the general process at that time was that you'd get seeds of the plants, and then you'd look how the genes was inherited and all of this stuff. Well, you know, I think the one thing with our team is we were focused on trying to control the problem. So instead of waiting to get seeds, we cloned line 55-1. You know, Maureen Fitch cloned it, and we applied for USDA to get a permit to do a field trial on the experimental station at the University of Hawaii on the island of Oahu, where the virus was bad, and Richard Manzard headed that small field trial. It was less than a quarter of an acre. And so the clones were planted out starting in April 1992, and throughout the several months, the clones were planted out. And then, you know, naturally, we had non-transgenic plants that were inoculated with the virus. And then, essentially, we would let the aphids do the transmitting of the virus. The field trial was started in April 1992. In May 1992, Steve Ferreira and I were returning from Guam. We had gone there to actually work on testing out the cross protection in Guam with our mild strain. And when we flew back to Oahu, May 1st, we got off the plane on Honolulu, and Steve Ferreira's technician and my son, Andrew, who was a graduate student at that time, met us at the airport, and he said, you know, we better go to the Big Island. So we jumped on the plane, went to the Big Island, and lo and behold, the long-awaited invasion of papaya ring spot was discovered in Puna. So what we were afraid would happen had happened. So in May 1992, Puna was infected with the virus. So the interesting part here is that we had greenhouse evidence that our line 55-1 would work. We fast forwarded, you know, within a year later, we were already now putting in clones of that line in a small experimental plot. And then 1 month after we started experiments, then you find the virus had gone into Kapoho. So now you have a potential scientific solution, and now you have a potential devastation of the industry. So the state of Hawaii, they tried their very best. They built a task force to go in and try to chop down virus-infected plants, and then they'd have a system where they'd go scout and they'd see a virus-infected plant, and then they'd chop it down and cut down plants that were within a radius of 100 feet or so. They tried all kind of stuff, but sadly, by October 1994, the state of Hawaii concluded that they could not control the virus. So now the industry is really in bad shape, because now 95% of the crop is in trouble, and by that time the virus has spread to about half the crop in 2 years. So here we're doing a field test in Oahu, the small, less than a quarter of an acre field test. Now, so this line that we had was actually a female clone of the sunset papaya, which is a sibling of sunrise. You're probably very familiar with sunrise.
Yes.
Which is and the industry liked the yellow flesh. So Richard Manzard works to get the coat protein, get the line 55-1, which is female, so he crosses with hermaphrodite non-transgenic sunset, and then he selves until he gets a line of genetically engineered sunset that is homozygous for the coat protein gene. So then he gets that, and then he makes a cross of the sunset, which is genetically engineered, line 55-1, with the dominant non-transgenic papaya called Kapoho. It's yellow flesh. Yellow is dominant over red. The flesh is yellow. So it's more kind of oranges, a nice, beautiful color. And he does it in a very small field trial. That's the thing. It's no big replicated field. It's a small field trial. He selects it. So by 1995, within 3 years after he put the field trial in, we have the rainbow papaya, which is a F1 hybrid between the transgenic sunset and Kapoho. And then the sunset, the transgenic sunset, is renamed, is called Sunup papaya. It's a red flesh, excellent papaya, homozygous for the coat protein gene. So we have the Sunup, and then we have the rainbow papaya. And what is developing there? By 1995, the industry is huge problem. My gosh, there, I mean, it's the virus is all over. So they are very, very nervous and worried. And you know, some packing houses are starting to go under. So there's a lot of tension. Actually, a lot of tension. A faithful thing is done. I was at the biotech conference in California, and I met this USDA regulator. His name was Fudin. And I said, hey, you know, do you think it's possible that we might be able to put a field trial in the middle of the devastated area? Because we have something that looks good in the field on Oahu, but we really got to see whether it works, you know, where ground zero is. And he said, well, you know, make an application and send it in. So we did that. At that time, Steve Ferreira, who had joined the project, he was an extension plant pathologist, he led the establishment of the field trial in Kapoho. Now, the field trial was in Rusty Perry's farm, and at that time, you know, it had to be where there's no papaya around. So he actually bulldozed some area that had citrus on one side, banana on one side, and then just forest on another side. And the thing is that there was a small papaya field. It just must have been about an eighth of an acre that he had planted that was virus infected. So within that area, the area was fenced out. We did this field trial, and using the Sunup papaya and the rainbow papaya, all replicated and all of this stuff. And then also we did a solid block of rainbow papaya, and it's surrounded by non-transgenic papaya. And I don't know if you've seen the picture. That's a famous
aerial picture. Yes, that's a very famous picture. Photo. Well, I show that so in all my talks.
It's good to get the history of that because, you know, this here now is we did that field trial very quickly because the industry was in big trouble. And I can tell you the tension was very high, and some of the growers didn't think that it would work and all of this stuff. So, you know, we wanted to do the field trial to really see if that thing could work under the gun. And, well, it was started in October 1995, and within 8-9 months, oh my gosh, you could see that huge difference. And I'll never forget the day when we held the first, just like a public display of the field trial. Growers came, packers came, and all of this stuff. It was late 1996, early 1997. Oh my gosh, they turned, you know, they're going through this banana field, and they turn right and they see this block, dramatic difference. They say, oh my gosh, incredible. Then the question is, when can we get it? And we say, oh, sorry, you cannot get it because this thing is regulated. So he said, well, how are we going to get it deregulated? Well, you know, we had no money and all of this stuff. But here is where we step out of our comfort zone, us scientists, because we are committed to trying to help the industry. We ourselves, you know, did the experiments and wrote up the applications. I wrote up the applications for USDA, submitted it in January 1996. And all of this stuff was done by us with almost very little money. We were very fortunate to have Senator Inouye give us a, quote, park barrel money. John Sanford and I actually tried to get a competitive grant, but we didn't get it. But anyway, the bottom line is that we just did what had to be done. And so by 1996, 1997, you know, we're convinced that we have something that is resistant, and the packers look at the papaya, oh my gosh, this rainbow papaya is pretty good papaya, looks pretty good. And Steve Ferrer did an excellent job in monitoring the field and was replicated, and he published a beautiful paper in Plant Disease on that field trial. But so the next step was going from what looks good in the field, up to that is all science, you've done it in the field, now you get into the red zone. You got to translate your science into something. That's translational biotechnology. And in order to reach your audience, the farmers, you got to get it deregulated. You don't get it deregulated, that is nice and academic, but it's not going to help. So we worked through it, and then literally 6 years, almost to the day that the virus was discovered in Pune in May 1992, on May 1st, 1998, seeds of rainbow papaya and sun of papaya were distributed to the growers free, because the state of Hawaii had given funds to the papaya industry and whatnot to produce seeds and so forth. So the seeds were given to the growers free, and nearly what 18 years later, it still is going, and things look very good. So you know, that's sort of like the inside story of the transgenic papaya.
It's really nice to hear the inside story, because I can hear in your voice just the excitement of seeing it working, and can kind of picture with you how this thing, just, you know, the discovery that you've maybe solved the problem. And what happened that first year? I know that you said that the industry was really in bad shape, but was it really almost immediate that it turned around based upon the new papaya?
Yes. You know, by 1998, actually in 1992, Pune had harvested 53 million pounds of papaya. By 1998, the harvest was down to 26 million pounds of papaya, and nearly all of them were infected with the virus. And then several packing houses had gone out of business, and so it was a bad bad situation. So, you know, the growers that, and, you know, some growers did not want to be the first to plant, but I was just talking to Alberto Bell, who's a great friend of mine, just several days ago, because they try to do a video to, you know, show what the papaya did for people and so forth. So he said, oh my gosh, 1997, he had planted 70 acres of non-transgenic papaya. He didn't harvest a single fruit. Can you imagine that? He had used lots of money to plant that. The virus came in, wiped them out. Then, in 1998, he got seized from the industry, and he was going to check it out. He was going to test it. Some people didn't want to go yet. He said, well, I'll get it much seized. And then he planted, I think, over 10 acres of the rainbow papaya. And several days ago, we stood at the very spot where he planted his first rainbow papaya. And 18 years later, he's been planting rainbow papaya, and he has two of his kids has gone to college. He support. You hear him tell the story. You know, he's just very happy that, you know, of this technology, and it helped him. And you know, I a lot of people ask me to for various interviews, and they want to go see. So I go take them to go see Alberto Belmez, and you know, and when I go there and I see, oh my gosh, you know, it's amazing. 18 years later, the rainbow papaya is growing beautiful.
And the resistance and the mechanism still seems to be holding up very well, right?
Yes, and you know, that was a big question that a lot of people had. You know, even the regulars, hey, what do you think is going to hold up? And we said, well, we don't know, but I felt it was going to hold up, mainly because, you know, my as a virologist, I felt that the population of the virus in Hawaii was pretty homogeneous. It was introduced in 1945, but not, I don't think too many other introduction of the virus strains came in. And you know, so we tested it against a number of isolates of the virus from Hawaii, and it showed a good resistance. And we looked at the sequence homology, you know, was very high. We did not know the mechanism back in 1992, but now when you look at it, it's RNAi. So you know, so you have the code protein gene, and for a virus to mutate so much, so that it will have such a different homology in the code protein, I think that's very unlikely. I think the danger of breakdown is that other strains of the virus would be introduced into Hawaii. And in fact, in 1994, we tested that idea. I thought at first, oh my gosh, this papaya, I'm going to save the whole world. This thing going to work? So we then, you know, we got different strains of the virus at Cornell, since no papaya is grown there, only in the greenhouse. We got strains from Thailand, Taiwan, and Florida and other places, and oh my God, we published this paper. Man, the strains from Taiwan and Thailand just broke down the resistance of the rainbow papaya. And when you look at the mechanism, that's how we published a lot of papers. But basically, the rainbow papaya is a hybrid, and it's hemizygous for the code protein gene. Now, the resistance of the sana papaya, which is homozygous for the code protein gene, is much stronger than the rainbow papaya that is hemizygous. And we've published all of this stuff. But I think the resistance in Hawaii going to hold up for a long time because, you know, Hawaii is very strict about introducing papaya plants to, you know, from outside of Hawaii. So unless some new strains get smuggled in, I think the chances of rainbow being overcome is not that great.
And one of the really nice sides of the story is you mentioned you were at Cornell, but you are a native Hawaiian. So how did it feel to be able to solve a problem in your homeland while at Cornell?
You know, that is one of the most satisfying, I think, things in my scientific career. From 1978 from 2002, and I retired from Cornell, I came back to Hawaii 2-3 times a year on the research. And you know, I knew all of these people. I mean, you know, knew all of them. And so we were really good buddies and so forth. But, you know, the satisfaction to me is, you know, I was born and raised on a sugar plantation. And my parents, my dad started working on the sugar plantation when he was 13 years old, so he never got to finish school. And so we were just plantation laborers. And a lot of the people in the papaya farmers were first generation Filipinos who had come to Hawaii, and they liked farming. So a lot of their part-time job was raising papaya. And, you know, they knew when the virus came, they knew that, oh my gosh, we gotta raise the papaya tree not growing good. But if you ask them about what is the virus, what is the transgenic plant, they really don't know. So, but they could see it working. And so here is where, you know, as a scientist, you know, I mean, for me, I definitely don't want to release anything that is not safe for consumption and not safe for the environment. So it's satisfying that we could help people who actually could not help themselves. They're not from big companies and all of this stuff. And that is the most satisfying thing today. In fact, just the other day, my wife and I were walking into Home Depot, and then this Filipino, kind of youngish Filipino guy, hey, Dennis, and I see, oh, he's a papaya grower, and we start talking and all of this stuff. That's the satisfaction that I have, you know, in trying to utilize this technology. And, you know, it's probably going to be my last publication. I was invited to write the prefatory chapter for the annual review of phytopathology. And when they contacted me, they said, you know, Dennis, you know, don't focus on all the scientific stuff that you did, but just kind of tell us your story. Where did you come from? How did you come to this this stature that you are? And so the title of my prefatory chapter was The Wayward Hawaiian Boy Returns Home. And I traced my career. You know, when I was a young kid, oh, stuttering was a huge problem, and I wouldn't ask questions and this and that. My grades were not that good, but a guy, Dr. Eduardo Trujillo, hired me as a technician on Kauai. And, you know, I think my grade point average was 2.5 when I finished the university in horticulture. And so I was a technician on Kauai, and I was by myself, and he said, oh, Dennis, you know, there's the disease of papaya. Go look at it. And so I go trying to figure out what to do, trying to do experiments. But the thing about that, I did not know what I wanted to do. I had no inkling of being a scientist. Oh, my gosh, when I did that, when I was on Kauai and I did those, I said, oh, my gosh, this thing is so interesting. And then, you know, I wanted then to do research, but, oh, I looked at my grades. Oh, my goodness. I don't think I can get into graduate school. So I sheepishly, I asked, and I guess I was doing a good job as a technician, so I asked Eduardo Trujillo, Hey, Eduardo, do you think there might be a chance I can go to graduate school? And he looked at me and said, oh my gosh, Dennis, I don't know, but you know, okay, why don't you apply? And somehow I got into graduate school and started on probation. But you know, once you know what you want to do and so forth, I got good grades and all of this stuff. And so, but he used to tell me, you know, when I was doing my master's degree, actually on tomato spotted wheel of papaya, I was doing my master's degree on that. And he would tell me, you know, Dennis, and I was actually pretty good in biochemistry. He said, you know, Dennis, don't just be a test tube scientist. Do something to help people. That Eduardo Trujillo was a most incredible plant pathologist. My gosh. You know, he knew plant pathology. So I kind of took that into heart. And then, but I still started. I was very poor at speaking. So then I got accepted at UC Davis. And so 1968, never been on a jet plane. Never been out of Hawaii. My wife Carol and two young kids. My son was only 3 months old, and my daughter was less than 2 years old. We flew off to California, and then at Davis, and I, you know, went to school. And I actually, my major professor was Robert Shepard, actually the guy who discovered cauliflower mosaic virus and DNA. But as I did my experiments there, and I was still stuttering, but my grades were good, my research was good, he would tell me, I would get all my data, and I rush to him and tell, hey, I got this, and we look at it, and then he put his arms, you know, together. Now, Dennis, tell me, what have you really accomplished with all these experiments you did? And that's a sobering thing for your major professor to ask you. Essentially, you know, you're going around doing all of this stuff, but tell me, out of all that stuff you did, what have you really accomplished? So those two things are the stuff that I kept. What Eduardo Trujillo told me, Dennis, just don't be a test tube scientist. Do something to help people. And my major professor in Davis tell me, Dennis, what have you really accomplished? And those are good things to keep in mind. So I sort of followed that the tenet, those advice throughout my career. If you look at my records, I published a lot of papers and whatnot, but a lot of them are you know, some really basic work, but always trying to translate the results. And I think that's what helped our team to be that is different from other research teams. You know, when we first got resistance in a greenhouse, oh my gosh, one of our colleagues said, oh my gosh, our job is done, man, this is great, we're going to publish it. I think it was published in Nature Biotechnology and this, mm-hmm. this and that. I said, oh no, we got to get this thing to the grower. See, it's that kind of attitude. And that's what I learned from these two professors that gave me a chance. And funny, at Davis, I was studied a lot. I was a good student, good researcher. But this guy, this professor, Dennis, what's going to happen? My gosh, you finish up, you go to meetings, and you can't even talk good. So lo and behold, about 5 months before I'm finishing up, University of Florida at Lake Alfred had a job opening. I applied, and they asked me to go and interview in Lake Alfred mm-hmm. for the citrus virus. And I go there. And by that time, though, you know, I'm getting a bit more confident. Raising a sugar plantation, I wasn't very confident of my smarts. But at Davis, you know, I was, hey, my gosh, you know. So I was getting more confident. I practiced, but I still started. I practiced hard trying to get a seminar. So I go to Lake Alfred, and this guy, Herman Rice, his name was. Said, okay, now we're going to have Dennis Gonzalez give his seminar on the biology of the two sedimenting components of P. nation mosaic virus. And I get up there, and this is no lie, this is the truth. I get up there, I give my seminar, never studied a bit, and I haven't studied since.
So yeah. It was just a question of you finding your confidence and, you know, really growing into.
I think it was confidence. And so, you know, but I guess the point I'm getting at is I was never made to be a scientist. It's just fortunate that I was a technician and I loved it, and some people gave me a chance. And I've never forgotten my plantation roots. You know, I know where I come from, and I know how to relate to these people. I feel these people. I know how to relate to these papaya farmers. And these are the kind of emotions that drove our team to do the work and all of this stuff. And you know, we were very fortunate that it worked. But sadly, there's very few public sector, other public sector projects. And at some point, a lot of the land-grant universities are going to have to ask why. And I, you know, you hear all about the excuses, too much, it's too expensive, and you got to get intellectual property rights and all of this, and now with all this controversy. So, but, you know, and a lot of people tell me that I was just lucky. Well, I'm sure I was lucky, but, you know, that's it. But I think we need more examples, but unfortunately, we don't have too many other examples.
You know, I think your example is such a good one. And, you know, there's so many other scientists I can think of who share your passion for helping people and really want to do the right thing. But with today's regulatory climate, the hostility towards science that tends to be innovative or use genetic engineering, it makes it very difficult for us to be able to deploy those tools in meaningful ways. And you look at the trouble just with something like golden rice or the beta-carotene banana, you know, a very humanitarian-centric opportunity that is just hindered by regulatory and by those that really are not excited about the technology. It's really disappointing.
Yeah, I you know, what you said is absolutely true. And, you know, my take is I think we need to go small step by small step. You know, the golden rice, the vitamin A enriched banana, even cassava, they're a big problem. Man, it's going to be great to solve those problems. And I'm on a scientific advisory board for that, the grant to make cassava resistant to the viruses. But my take is, why don't we just do some small things, maybe some you know, some tomatoes to help Florida, or tomatoes to help other stuff. You know, just go one step at a time, and you can learn from all of these things. And part of all of this stuff is really an art. It's really an art on how to get these things done. Because, and you know, today there's a lot of opposition, but I am certain you can get it done. Absolutely certain.
If I gave you a grant for $10 million and said, you know, Dr. Gonsalves, could you please solve a problem that you would like to solve? What would that be?
You know, what I would do is I would work, and I don't have to spend the $10 million bucks, but I would work to ask the question, how can we deploy transgenic crops in which the technology works and is safe, like a virus-resistant papaya or a virus-resistant squash or something like this? How can we utilize these examples as a way to learn how we can deploy the technology under different scenarios somewhere there, or how can we work towards you somewhere the society may be so much against, like Europe, or somewhere they may be a little lukewarm, like Japan, or some may be in China where they're opportunistic. You know, all of these things are different ways. Each in Africa, where they really need it. But yeah, there's a lot of opposition. All of these things are interesting research and sociological questions that you cannot answer that until you actually have done it. And so, great, you can do with golden rice, but you know, rice is a huge crop. People, I mean, this is big, mega. Papaya is not. But what you see, but you learn the same thing. You got to do the same thing. You got to do the same psychology. And, you know, a lot of people don't know about the situation that I encountered in Thailand. Oh, my gosh, it breaks my heart. Sometimes I wake up at night. I just wake up because I failed in Thailand. You know, in 1995, the government of Thailand came to me and said, "Hey, Dennis," and I had been working in Thailand since 1986 to try to control the virus. Cross protection did not work. We had introduced a tolerant variety that it grew but got infected. So they came to me. Undersecretary of Agriculture came to me. Department of Agriculture came to us at Cornell and said, "Dennis, how can we utilize transgenic papaya?" I said, "Well, you know, why don't you send me a scientist? They don't have to be trained. Send me a scientist to Cornell. We'll try to transform your big papaya, but this scientist is going to do it. And you give me $15,000 for supplies." They sent the scientist there. And I have a picture. 1997. I have a picture of my wife and I. We carried some of the tissue culture papaya in the tubes, and some of the tissue culture papaya all under permit. And the scientists had come to Cornell. Within a year and a half, we had developed a transgenic line that looked resistant in a greenhouse. We took back a lot of that. We flew to Thailand. The regulators, all the quarantine people met us. And, you know, I have a slide of that with the Thai Airlines plane behind me. And you know what I said? A hope is born. I thought, oh, my gosh. We're going to help these poor people in Northeast Thailand. So the Department of Agriculture people, they took that project, and I go there every year. They took that project. By 1999, 2000, they had the same kind of results we had in Hawaii, but with the big papaya. I have some beautiful pictures there. And they did. Then they started to try to get deregulation. They did rabbit feeding studies. They checked under the soil of where the papaya is grown and all of this stuff. So by April 2002, I go back. And oh my gosh, things are looking hopeful. Because, you know, way back in 2000, I think, the government of Thailand had shut down permits to do on-farm field trials because some biotech company and some cotton or something went loose, so they shut it down. But in 2004, the summer of 2004, they were going to open up for doing field trials and to get things deregulated in Thailand. You know, you got to do on-farm field trials. So anyway, it was getting set. And, you know, I have a picture. In 1986, I took a picture, and most every time I give a talk, there's a picture of my Thai friend. Really, she's kind of old. In 2004, I took a picture of her. She was 92 years old, and I thought, oh my gosh, this big, beautiful papaya, resistant to the virus, maybe very soon I'm going to deliver that papaya to her village. My gosh, the summer of 2004, Greenpeace jumped the fence, throw the fruit, starts a huge propaganda campaign. The papaya will never see the light of day. I failed in transferring the technology. I mean, it was the scientists in Thailand that were doing that, but you know, that was a start that I really wanted to complete, and unfortunately I failed. But what I'm getting at, unless I know how to do this kind of stuff, well, a lot of these people that do a lot of talking, they don't know. They got to learn. So with my $10 million, that's what I would do. You go with a technology that works. You know it's safe, so there's no question about safety. You know that environment. So now you have to look at the ideology, the politics, and the market, and all of this stuff. And unless you do those things, you're not going to get it through the red zone.
Well, that's a really great answer.
I
think it's a great way to wrap this up. I really appreciate you taking the time with me today. The last time I talked to you, I was in Kapa.
I know. And then I know you were very anxious to talk to people over there and all of this stuff. And I'm very sorry to hear all the trouble you have been through. That's the price that sometimes you have to pay. But I'm very, very strong about this. Unless public sector scientists do something to try to help solve problems of the clientele, and if the solution is a GMO, do that, the public is going to associate GMOs with the big companies. So I tell you, as sure as I'm sitting here, that's exactly what's going to happen, and that's exactly what is happening. And everybody, I understand, everybody wants to solve the problem. They're going to do the banana, great. They're going to do the rice, great. They're going to do all the things, great. But you know, those stuff are so fraught with politics and whatnot. Why don't you do something a little less so you don't need to? We're already developed. And then learn how these people think. See how they think. And then learn from this. And then you can get. They're the same thing. I tell you, we're going to get our papaya deregulated in mainland China probably by the first part of 2017. Yep, we're going to do it.
Well, I do think it's calmer waters ahead. And that night in Kapa, I had enjoyed talking to the people who were against the technology.
That was a very, very good time. But as you know, things got woo.
Oh yeah, I mean it got really ugly there. But especially on the main island, on the big island. But you know, I still have a lot of, I think that the people there have great passion and they're firm and very entrenched in their beliefs. And I feel very strongly that I don't want to invalidate their feelings, but I do want to help them understand. Yeah. And I think by helping them understand and really by helping them understand that we're on the same page, that we want healthy food for people, that we want a healthy environment, especially in the fragile systems of Hawaii. And that it's not about big companies. This is about helping people.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
So that's a message I'm trying to work on there. Maybe someday.
Yeah. Well, in a way, I've read all these things that you know, you've been under tremendous pressure and so forth. So you took a little break, but the world needs people like you. I'm on the way out already. I'm retired and all of this stuff. But unless we have people like you that really try to expound on the truth, then it's going to be tougher and tougher, because it's tough to stop these all these propagandas. So
Well, I always say I stand on the shoulders of giants, and those are your shoulders too. So
I
mean that very sincerely. I'm very grateful for the opportunities I've had too, and your story of coming up through school is very similar to mine. And just had some good mentors who gave me some breaks that maybe I didn't deserve. But years later, can look back on that very positively and now really want to translate all of this into very positive things going forward.
Yeah.
And we'll do it. I think it's only better times ahead. So,
man.
Yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me tonight. And thank you so much. And please take care.
Okay, I'll see you.
All right, thank you. We'll see you.
And that's Dr. Dennis Gonzalez calling all the way from Hawaii, talking about the early days of the papaya ring spot virus resistance in papaya. Thank you very much for listening to what has been a really special Talking Biotech, when we can remember that this is really about people and how we can use technology and innovation to change the lives of others in very positive ways. So thank you very much for listening once again. Send me your questions, send me your thoughts, and we'll talk to you next week on Talking Biotech.
The theme song from Hawaii 50 brings us to the end of the Talking Biotech podcast with your host, Kevin Folta. If you have questions, would like to request a guest, or have other tidbits you'd like to add to the show, please send them to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Tell a friend. Help us spread the word of science and science communication.